David E. Bone, and in this episode, we'll sit down and chat with Kate Early, attorney with Dayton area law firm Siebele, Shilto, and Dyer, and chair of the Epilepsy Foundation of Western Ohio. I'm joined here by Kate Early, attorney with Siebele, Shilto, and Dyer, a Dayton-based law firm.
Hi, David.
She specializes in business litigation. She is also chair of the Epilepsy Foundation of Western Ohio. She's on the board of the Dayton Ad Club, involved in a number of other philanthropic and social organizations in the Dayton area, and hails from Beaver Creek, Ohio.
Yes.
Thank you for joining me today, Kate. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me for this podcast. I appreciate that.
I wanted to start by talking about what you do professionally, which is the practice of law, and what drew you into the practice of law.
Well, I actually, believe it or not, wanted to be a lawyer since I was in the fourth grade. I know that sounds sort of like a cliche, but it happens to be true for a number of attorneys here. I had four different things that I wanted to be in the fourth grade. One was a fashion designer, believe it or not, a biochemist, an oceanographer, but I really didn't pass swimmers too, so I figured no, and a lawyer. And the lawyer just fit perfectly as I started to grow up and read more books and see different arguments for different things. And I also have an attorney in my family, Scott Early, who's my uncle. He used to be head legal counsel for the Chicago Board of Trade, and now he's with Foley and Lardner doing securities litigation in Chicago. So,
excellent. Yeah, I guess oceanographer may not be the best career for someone from Beaver Creek.
No, I didn't. I like the idea that, you could talk to dolphins, and that was really kind of cool when I was in the fourth grade. So,
well, like marketers, attorneys must be really, really great storytellers to be successful. There's a huge component in that, especially in litigation. So if you could talk about the importance of crafting a story and how that helps in making a convincing argument.
Well, when you craft your story, it's basically a way to tell your audience what happened and what you think the result should be by a lap. But you also want to sort of tell them where you think that you should go, but you want the facts and your organization of the facts to lead them to that conclusion on their own, so that they're not just being told what to do, but they actually feel that it's the right conclusion and they get there on their own. And, you know, sometimes it depends who your audience is, if your audience is the judge or the jury, how you frame that argument. Obviously, framing it for a jury, you're going to be a little bit more concerned with whether your references are appropriate for a number of people who may or may not have different backgrounds or references that they know about, versus a judge who's heard a lot of the same arguments in the law over and over again. And you also take into account whether you organize your facts just by the chronology or whether you put things in a different order, because primacy and recency seem to, as they say, make a lot of difference. And I'm sure that comes a lot in to play in marketing too, where you position your facts, where you position your best facts. And then you also may have analogies that you use. And there again, with a judge, you might use different analogies than you might use with a jury. And then you might use some phrases that everybody lives by, you know, like an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, those sorts of things. And you have to be careful with how many of those you use, because the other side can turn those against you if you're not careful. Basically, there's also a distinction between how much of the facts you emphasize versus how much of the law you emphasize, depending on if you have really good facts or you have really good law, and which is more in your favor, I guess you could say.
So I guess in the business world, it would equate to sort of understanding your external environment, understanding your target market.
Yes.
And then connecting the opportunities and strengths of your argument with the opportunities presented.
Absolutely. Going with your core competencies, as I say.
Enhancing your strengths.
Yes.
Let's shift into a little more specifics of the law, and especially as it pertains to social networking, new media. I know a lot of folks that visit this site and listen to this podcast are interested in technology and how that impacts marketing specifically. And I know you spent some time in that area relative to the law. So if you could talk about how social networking is impacting the law, changing the law, some important things that marketers might need to know.
Okay. A couple of things. I do a fair share of intellectual property and trademark type litigation. One thing that comes up a lot is you can always find a web page. There are caches. A lot of people, I'm sure if they're sophisticated enough to be reading or listening to the podcast, rather, on your blog, they know about Google caches. You also probably know that they're really hard to get rid of. You have to petition Google and all the rest of it. There's also something called the Wayback Machine. We use this in law all the time to try and find, for instance, we find somebody who's infringing, we tell them to take it down, then they put up another website. Well, we can still find that website if nobody printed it off to use that then in litigation against them. MySpace pages and like. More and more, we're looking at them when we research someone because we're going to take their deposition or we go to trial and we're going to examine a witness. We go and we look up all sorts of things about that witness and get a background profile of them. More and more, we're looking at the social networking sites as well to find out what they're saying. I've even found cases where people's kids have talked about the litigation on their MySpace pages. So even if they don't have one, we look up, you know, their family's websites, and it's interesting what you can find. It's just interesting what you can find. Sometimes you can just, they get a little scared when you whip out a webpage that they've written, and they start to think you know everything about them.
When in fact you may, if they have shared it with the world.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So be careful what you put out there. There's also some other things that I might mention about the internet and how it's affected companies. A lot of companies are now having blogs, and a lot of people ask me about liability on the internet and what they need to do to protect themselves. There's a couple of issues here. One is that I suggest that companies have a blog or internet use policy. And let me take a moment here to make a disclaimer that anything that I am saying here in this entire podcast, I have to make the disclaimer that nothing that I'm saying here is intended as legal advice. And if any of you have special circumstances that you're thinking about, I encourage you to consult with an attorney about your special circumstances, because there are always exceptions and differences for different circumstances. But generally, I encourage people to have blog policies or internet use policies. And I also explain that there are some statutes out there that govern the use of the internet in circumstances like when you would have a blog. For instance, if you have a blog and you don't have any rights to edit the content before it's posted, the comment code content before it's posted, it just automatically posts as a part of your blog, then generally you are going to, your blog site is going to be immune under the Communication Decency Act. But if it develops the information or if it approves comments before they are posted, then you could be liable as a republisher of that information. For anything that says, for instance, if there's some sort of libel or other, you know, action based on that information, you could be just as liable because you republished that information. It's as if you adopted that speech. So you want to be careful and take that into consideration when you decide whether or not to have a blog that automatically publishes information or not. There's also business implications with whether or not you decide to automatically have things posted. And that is, you know, you have to sit there and monitor it if you want to republish it quickly. So let's see what else. I also want to explain that bricks and mortars type laws generally apply to the internet. So if there's some sort of maybe menacing or stalking issues going on, I mean, those apply in the real world and they apply on the internet. if there's some sort of copyright issues or intellectual property issues, you know, just because you can't, you know, you think, you know, you can't do it in the real world, you know, you got to be careful when you go in the internet. So I think that pretty much covers what I can tell you about that right now.
How about a few quick tips from a seasoned attorney to a marketer, or any marketers out there listening?
Sure. I think that the first thing I normally say to people in advertising is to be careful, because obviously, you know, for copyright infringement purposes, there's a defense called fair use. But without getting too deep into what fair use is and whether certain circumstances are fair use or not, just realize that it's probably not as broad as you might think. So keep that in mind and make sure that you've taken into account the different possible repercussions for those uses. Next thing that I would say is to be careful that you use caution in comparative advertising. And what's going to be examined here is the likelihood of buyer confusion for whether or not there was, like, for instance, trademark infringement. For instance, if you use another competitor's mark in your comparative advertising, you want to make sure that you accurately depict it and you don't alter it. You also want to make sure you don't apply any affiliation or sponsorship by your competitor. And you want to, of course, make sure you can substantiate any claims you make about your competitor. And you be careful you don't get into sort of false advertising type issues with that. Another hot tip, I guess you could say, would be to make sure that when you're registering your domain names, you register not just your company's name and any misspellings of your company's name, for instance, but you also want to register for domain names, any brands that you have or might have. Brands, remember, can be more than just trademarks. You can register them as each is a .net, .com, anything like that that you can, and have them all direct to the same website. You want to not forget that country domain names exist, and you might want to get different country domain names if you want to be international.
We went with my company. We're a service-based company.
Yeah.
So we registered our tagline as a domain name. It's actually a domain name for our blog.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's a little different in that we don't have a product type of brand, but a service type of
brand. It works, and that helps to capture. I mean, that is part of your brand. Your tagline ends up becoming part of your brand when you're a service company. It helps to define your brand. You also want to make sure that you are registering all your misspelled domain names and that you're not infringing on another's mark when you do all of this. So then be sure that you do enough research to make sure that you're not infringing. Another tip would be about work-for-hire agreements. There's a lot of intricacies to work-for-hire agreements, believe it or not. The default rule is generally that the work is owned by the employer when the employee is employed to create a work. But the employee then owns work created outside the scope of his employment. So you want to make sure that you look at any sort of employment agreement that you have and see if there's any assignments or work-for-hire provisions in that agreement, and if it says the type of things in your job description, you know, if that covers what you're concerned about.
Does that speak to sort of, at the end of the day, who owns the idea?
Right.
Or who owns the product?
The product. You also want to know that independent contractors, such as outside photographers or creatives, they own the work they create unless it is agreed otherwise. So if you're a company that's hiring a photographer to come in and take great pictures for your website, you want to take a good look at that contract and make sure that it has everything in there that you need, because you don't want to get in a situation where it's unclear as to who owns the pictures you're going to put up on your website. So you definitely want to make sure that you have a work-for-hire or a made-for-hire, sometimes they're called, agreement signed before a contractor or a freelancer starts work. but there are only 9 statutory types of works that you can have works for hire agreements with independent contractors. Keep in mind, this is with independent contractors. And there's a whole list of them that include commissions for contribution to a collective work, translations, compilations, you know, and there's some others. But that's in the statute. But so as a backup to all of this, you might just make sure that the work for hire agreement contains an assignment, and that just sort of is a belt and suspenders kind of thing.
Okay. Shifting gears a little bit, we both serve on the board of the Epilepsy Foundation of Western Ohio.
We do.
An organization which I love. And I wanted to see what drew you to get involved with the Epilepsy Foundation. You, I'm new to the board of the foundation and new to the foundation itself. I know you've spent some time involved with the organization and wanted to find out what drew you to get involved, what keeps you involved, and why the Epilepsy Foundation is important.
Well, I have family members that have epilepsy, and so it's near and dear to my heart, some that are controlled and some that aren't controlled. And for the listeners out there, I thought I'd explain what epilepsy is. A lot of people don't realize that epilepsy is a condition in which a person has 2 or more seizures without a clear cause. It's not really connected to a certain other thing that they know about. Some people refer to themselves as having a seizure disorder, or their doctors diagnose them as having a seizure disorder, but technically, if they've got 2 or had 2 or more, it's epilepsy. And it's a surprising number of people that have epilepsy.
50 million.
It's amazing, isn't it? And a lot of people just don't talk about it. They still think of it as something very scary and embarrassing almost. When so many people are controlled, it's amazing. So, and I think a lot of people who are controlled just don't talk about it. So I felt like there's a lot of education to be done, and I think a lot of parents get really, you know, scared and rightfully frightened with this new thing when they've heard nothing next to nothing about it, and their child is diagnosed with epilepsy, and the children themselves or the adults themselves wonder if their life is over. I mean, you know, whether or not they're going to be able to drive, whether or not they're going to be able to hold down a job. These are very real concerns for people who have uncontrolled epilepsy. And in the beginning, when you're just diagnosed, you don't know if you're going to be able to be controlled. So there's a lot of fear and whatnot associated with that. And it's comforting to hear from other people who have it or who have family members that have had it, that it can be controlled in some instances, and how other people have dealt with it when they're not able to be controlled.
If others want to get involved with the group, currently, I know we are looking for people to serve in a number of different roles.
Sure.
If someone out there decides, hey, I'd love to get involved with this organization, I would like to help out, talk about some ways they might be able to do that.
Okay. Well, we're always looking for interested volunteers, volunteers to help at the office. We have an office in Huber Heights currently, and volunteers to help out with some of our events. And some of our fundraising. We are also always looking for volunteers for our committees on our board. We're talking about committee members that would not necessarily serve on the board, but might serve on event committees or finance committees or programs committees. We're also looking for maybe doctors that are interested to serve on our professional advisory board. And we are always taking applications for the board itself. If someone so desires to and is ready, willing, and able to step up with that commitment.
I think the event committees as well as sort of the functional committees, the marketing and the finance and fundraising committees, really offer a unique opportunity for people to, especially young professionals, to A, network with other young professionals.
Oh, absolutely.
And do so in a way that really makes a difference.
Oh, it absolutely makes a difference. And you can see that at every one of these events that you go to. Yeah, I mean, it just brings tears to your eyes at how much these people are really there to support the organization and are so thankful that the organization was there for them.
And I think it's worth mentioning that with some of the population trends in the area, with things like hospital consolidation and other trends, We have experienced a downturn in terms of active committee members, active board members, and through natural attrition as well.
Sure.
So really that is something that we have recently decided that needs to be a focal point for the organization.
Oh, absolutely.
As well. So we really are aggressively seeking out people to help.
Come on board. Send me an email.
And if someone did want to get information, mm-hmm. where could they find that?
Well, like I said, you can email me at kearly, that's my first initial and my last name, E-A-R-L-Y, at ssdlaw.com, or you could call the organization if you have organization-type questions, or you can go to the website and get all the contact information there. That's at www.ohioepilepsy.org. One of our big events is coming up, and that is Mud Volleyball. That's coming up on July 12th. That's a Saturday. We need volunteers for usually the Sunday for the setup, Saturday, and then
Friday for the setup,
Saturday for the event, and then Sunday for takedown. We would love to have volunteers. You can go to www.daytonmud.com. to sign up. If you'd still like to sponsor, there's some sponsorship information on there. If you'd like to have a team come play, there's information on there for that as well. We also have a golf scramble that happens in the fall. There's also a wine and jazz event that happens in November, which is Epilepsy Month. And there's a Mardi Gras, which happens in February, which is a very prestigious, I think it's black tie or semi-black tie, depending. Event, and that's a heck of a lot of fun. So if you'd like to sponsor, or your company would like to sponsor those events, you can give the organization a call.
Talk a little bit more about Mud Volleyball for those who've never gone to the Mud Volleyball mm-hmm. event. It certainly is our biggest event of the year, typically wildly successful and a heck of a lot of fun. Talk about what it's all about.
Sure.
What can people expect if they decide to go to Mud Volleyball?
Mud Volleyball is basically a volleyball tournament done in the mud.
imagine that.
Yeah, imagine that. If you're going to go, I highly suggest you take lots of sunscreen and duct tape for your shoes, because as you're walking along, your shoes kind of, the mud sucks them off your feet. But it's a heck of a lot of fun. I personally I don't like to sweat. So I'm not one for playing sports and that sort of thing. I'm more of, in sitting in the corner with my nose in a book, but I thought, well, heck, I'm not going to have much fun at mud volleyball, but I went, the first year and volunteered, and it was just so much fun. I volunteered a couple of shifts, every year thereafter. The people are just great. Everybody is in a very collegial atmosphere. It's like a party type atmosphere. You don't have to get dirty if you don't want to. there's ways around that. I did have one guy, I was working at the gate 1 year, and I did have one guy say that, okay, come on, you've been standing at the gate collecting, money as spectators come in. Because there's a small spectator fee for the organization. And I haven't seen you get dirty yet. So he ran after me to give me a great big hug. He was all covered with mud. So I had mud on my back. But barring that, barring a hugger, a serial hugger, you should be fine. But it is a lot of fun. It's been going on for something like 18 or 20 years, a long time. And then the people come back year after year after year.
We have, last year we sold out of team spots.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
If you're hearing this and it's prior to the event, get your registration in ASAP.
Yeah.
Slots fill up fast. And we are actually ahead of schedule from where we were last year. So if you are interested in participating, you may want to visit DaytonMud.com and get your team registered ASAP.
Absolutely.
Well, finally, I wanted to talk about the fact, clearly you're a very busy young professional. You're very well respected and really do a great job getting things done in all areas of your life. And I wanted to see how you manage to stay organized, how you sort of manage to be involved, in charge, and engaged in all of these different activities, and do so at a high level. So how do you, in short, how do you get all this stuff done?
Yeah. many to-do lists, many redundant systems in effect. In law firms, you generally have a docketing system, so for each of your cases, it appears on your Outlook what you need to do that day. A lot of times, I'll shoot an email to my assistant, Leanne's great, and I just have her put stuff on my calendar. Sometimes I'll put on my calendar just reminders that I need to do something and have it done on that day, even if it's not an appointment. I have to-do lists on my desk, and I also have a great big whiteboard that's 2 months long, so I can see out 2 months in advance. It's color-coded as to whether it's work, whether it's networking or that sort of thing, or if it's personal. So that way I keep everything in line and moving. I started trying to use the Outlook task feature, but I got to say, I don't know how that's going to work out.
I've tried that several times.
So what do you use?
Depends on which day of the week it is.
Yeah.
I am a serial offender of trying to constantly find a more efficient system. And in doing so, making myself less efficient.
Yeah.
As I seek out the optimal system. I use probably a combination of a web-based tool called Tootly-Do,
mm-hmm.
which allows me, I sort of use that as just a repository where I can dump ideas, tasks, etc. But then I use a good old pen and paper, and I'll go through, pull up stuff on the web in terms of a giant list, review that, and say, okay, well, the five things I really have to get done today, I write those down on a piece of paper and physically cross them off
mm-hmm.
as the day goes on. And I found that sort of keeps what's important top of mind and right in front of me. But by keeping things on the web and in that using that tool, it allows me to sort of have a ubiquitous tool that no matter where I am, typically I can get to the internet and I can store stuff there. Another great tool that I use is something called Jot.com,
mm-hmm.
J-O-T-T. It allows you to I have it programmed in my speed dial. I push 9. It answers the phone and says, who do you want to jot? I say myself. and from there, it takes my voicemail, transcribes it, and sends me an email. So that's great. I have a lot of windshield time in my commute.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then, I'll actually get a decent idea. And in fear that I might lose that, I'll grab my phone real quick and jot.com. I'll send it to myself. And then as soon as I get to somewhere where I can put that into my system, I'll plug that in. But it's a great way to make sure that the occasional great idea isn't lost into the ether.
So, redundant systems, the only way to go.
So, well, I want to thank you so much for,
well, thank
for spending
you.
The time today. I really enjoyed it. And
yeah, me too.
It was a pleasure.
Me too.